Can't sleep? Don't want to sleep? Afraid to sleep? Are the windows closed? Are your doors locked? Did you check your closet? And under your bed? Maybe you should keep a light on in the hallway, just in case. Now settle in. Make yourself comfortable. Lay back, close your eyes, and let me tell you a story.
The Luke in Time Mysteries begins with two private detectives. Luke, who's got a little bit of a drinking problem, and her partner Lyle, who's got a little bit of an eating problem. Together, they've got pretty big money problem. So when Marva walks into their office, offering gobs of cash, if they can find someone who's trying to kill her, they take the job without asking any question, which becomes their biggest problem, because soon enough, they walk into a trap and wind up dead. But that's not where this story ends. In fact, it's just the setup, because they go back to the moment where they first met Marva, and until Luke and Lyle can solve Marva's mystery, they keep dying over and over again. If this book sounds like something you'd enjoy, check the links in the show notes to learn more.
You can find out more about The Nine Lives of Marva DeLonghi and the Luke in Time Mysteries at jodyjsperling.com. There's a jar in Rodney's cupboard, one that's been there for as long as he can remember. No one will tell him what's inside, only that it must never be opened. A warning passed on through the generations in his family. Perhaps there's a good reason not to. It could just be an old jar filled with jam that turned bad decades ago. But maybe it's something more sinister. Something best left undisturbed. The jar in the cupboard. The jar had been there for as long as I could remember. It was there when I used to visit my grandparents on the weekends. It was there when my mother moved in to care for her aging parents until they passed. It was there the day I moved in after my own mother died suddenly from a stroke, years of chain smoking finally catching up to her. The jar in the cupboard. It sat by itself on a shelf, its dark, mysterious contents sealed away in the old-fashioned canning jar, the kind with a glass lid held in place by a metal spring clamp. I asked my grandmother once what was inside. "Nothing to concern you," she replied. I asked if I could open it. "No," she said sternly. "You must never open it." Then she set a large plate of breaded pork chops drenched in applesauce in front of me. "Eat," she urged. "A growing boy needs to eat." After my grandparents died, I was visiting my mother. We had a nice dinner together. I was cleaning up afterwards when I had the urge to see if the jar was still there. I opened the cupboard. There it was, sitting on the shelf, alone. I reached in and picked it up, hefting it in my hand. It felt heavier than it looked, even if it was full of something. "What are you doing? Put that back," my mother shouted from the doorway. She rushed over, snatched the jar from my hands, returned it to its place in the cupboard, and closed the door. She paused a moment to catch her breath. "What is it?" I asked. "Why do we have a jar in the cupboard that no one wants to open? Why not just throw it away?" My mother shook her head. "You don't understand." "Then explain it to me," I urged. She considered for a moment. "Yes, perhaps it is time you knew, but not tonight. Finish up and come watch my programs with me, okay?" "Sure," I promised. After muttering a silent prayer and crossing herself, she turned and shuffled back to the living room while I finished doing the dishes. That night, she died in her sleep. After the funeral, everyone came back to my grandmother's house. Well, it had been my mother's for several years, and was officially mine now, but I still thought of it as grandma's. Neighbors came bearing food, enough to feed me for weeks. Relatives I hadn't seen since my childhood stopped by to pay their respects. Even my Uncle Steve, my mother's brother, made an appearance. He lived in Alaska. I think I had met him twice in my life. There was some unspoken conflict between him and his parents that drove him away. He saw me, walked up, and gave me a big hug.
"Rodney, I'm so sorry for your loss," he said.
Then he added,
"You've grown so much since I last saw you. You're looking good."
"You too," I said. In truth, the years had not been kind. He was gaunt, his skin wrinkled and leathery, spotted with cancerous-looking moles. His hair was long, thick, and perfectly white, tied up in a ponytail. His suit looked to be almost as old as he was, and instead of a necktie, he had a bolo tie, sporting an oval of turquoise cinched around his neck.
"You're a terrible liar," he said laughingly. "Listen, I know I haven't been around much, but if there's anything I can do, you just let me know."
"Thanks," I said. "I'm fine."
"I'm sure you are. But like it or not, you're the closest family I've got left."
He was right. Most everyone else in attendance, except for a few distant cousins, were on my father's side, showing their support for me. My dad had passed away when I was in high school. He didn't have any brothers or sisters, but there were endless cousins of various degrees. "Well, if I'm ever in Alaska..." Uncle Steve smiled.
"Yeah, I guess we won't be bumping into each other at the grocery store. But you should come up for a visit sometime. It's a beautiful place."
"Maybe I will." He offered me a consoling smile, then turned to head back to the ad hoc dining room table buffet that had sprung up, tended by the woman who lived across the street, one of my mother's best friends. "Uncle Steve," I said. He turned around. "There is maybe one thing you can help me with."
"What's that?"
"What do you know about the jar in the cupboard?" The warm smile that had been so reassuring a moment ago disappeared, replaced by an expression of consternation. Then he laughed.
"That old thing is still in the kitchen?"
"Been there as long as I can remember."
"Yeah, it's been there since well before you were born, before your mother was born. It's part of the reason I left."
"Why was that?" I asked. "No one ever told me what happened, why you moved away." Steve shifted his gaze, scanning the room, sizing up the place.
"Your grandparents wanted me to take this house and live in it when they died. They told me it was my duty, that I would have to stay here for the rest of my life. Well, you can imagine how that sat with a 19-year-old kid who wanted to see the world. I packed my things and never looked back."
"Stay? Why?"
"Because of the jar."
"I don't understand." He looked around, seemingly afraid that someone might overhear us.
"I'm going to be in town for a while. Let's talk about this tomorrow, when there's not so many people around."
"That's what my mother said," I told him, "the night before she died." Steve nodded.
"Yeah, that certainly lends a little more urgency to the situation. Okay, let's get out of here," he said.
"I can't," I replied, gesturing at all the people milling around the house.
"They won't miss you. Come on, let's get some real food."
"Real food?"
"I need a cheeseburger, not tuna casserole."
Uncle Steve and I sat in the booth at Fred's Diner. It brought back a memory of me squeezed into a corner of maybe this very same booth, coloring the menu with broken crayons, while my mother and Uncle Steve argued about something on one of his rare visits. The waitress took our orders, topped off our coffee cups, and disappeared. I loaded my cup up with sugar and cream. Uncle Steve drank his black.
"What do you know about the jar?" he asked.
"Only that I'm not supposed to open it." He nodded.
"They never told you what was inside?"
No, what is it? Steve took a deep breath, steeling himself to answer me.
A demon, he said.
What?
It's a demon, supposedly.
Where did it come from?
It was exorcised from your Aunt Judith.
I don't have an Aunt Judith.
She was my older sister. Died before your mother was born.
How?
She was very sick, both physically and mentally. My parents believed she was possessed. They found a priest to perform an exorcism, and he allegedly cast the demon into the jar.
Why?
So that it couldn't come back and infect her again.
And you believe this?
Hell no, he said. That's why I left. I thought the whole thing was crazy. They wanted me to give up the rest of my life to live in that house and be the custodian of some canned demon.
What happened to your sister?
She died 2 weeks later.
The waitress brought us our cheeseburgers and malts. Steve showered his fries with salt and dipped them into the malt before tossing them in his mouth. What should I do? I asked.
Throw it away, he said. Bury it in the woods. Sell it on eBay. Hell, I'm sure there are plenty of crazies who would pay good money for a demon in a jar.
Maybe I'll open it, I suggested. Uncle Steve cocked his head.
Could be something nasty in there, demon or not. Not sure I'd take that risk.
He took a giant bite from his cheeseburger. I sucked some of my chocolate malt through the too thin straw.
My advice, Steve continued, is to sell that house and go on an adventure.
Maybe I will, I said, poking at my fries. Maybe I will. It was late when the last of the mourners left me alone in the house. The neighbor ladies had stuck around to clean up, do the dishes, and pack up all the leftovers into my fridge. I found a beer tucked behind a Tupperware container of cream puffs and cracked it open. After chugging nearly half of it, I set the bottle down and realized I was standing right in front of the cupboard. The cupboard with the jar inside. I opened it. It had been days since I last set eyes on the mysterious jar. And now that I knew the story behind it, it took on a whole new light. Or rather, darkness. The idea that it held a demon was ridiculous. There were no such things. My previously unknown aunt was probably bipolar or schizophrenic. Maybe she had a brain tumor that was affecting her behavior. Whatever it was not a demon. But that still left unanswered the question, what was inside? I lifted the jar off the shelf and set it down on the counter next to my beer. Then I picked up the bottle and finished it, hoping the alcohol would fortify my courage. I released the clamp, holding the lid in place. Despite decades of sitting in that cupboard, the rubber seal seemed intact. I pried off the lid. It came away with a pop. I braced myself for some disgusting, rotten smell, for some vile liquid to bubble out, or spores of black mold released in a deadly cloud. But none of that happened. The jar was empty. It was also no longer clouded in inky blackness. It was clear, and when I picked it up to look closer, it had lost that impossible heaviness and was light as a feather. I laughed. All those years, all that drama, the needless conflict between my uncle and the rest of my family. And the jar was empty. I put the lid back on and flipped the clamp in place. Then set it back in its spot in the cupboard, and went to bed. I awoke suddenly. The glowing numbers of my alarm clock let me know it was only 3:15 in the morning. Had there been a noise? Rodney, said a voice. I jumped out of bed, searching the darkness for the speaker. Who's there?
It's Judith, she said.
Judith? Where had I heard that name before? From Uncle Steve. That was the name of his sister. Aunt Judith? The one I had never even heard of until yesterday? How did you get in here?
You set me free, she said. Thank you.
What?
The jar, she said. You opened the jar.
There was nothing in the jar.
I was in the jar.
No, it was a demon, I claimed. Did I really believe that?
The demon tricked my parents and the priest. They captured my soul and trapped me while it made its escape.
I don't understand. There was another sound, glass breaking downstairs.
He's here, Judith whispered.
Who?
The demon.
I shook my head. Was I dreaming?
I turned on my bedside table lamp. The room was empty. There was no one there.
I heard the faint sound of a door opening and closing from the first floor.
Someone was breaking in. I turned the light back out, then tiptoed out into the upstairs hallway and peered over the railing guarding the stairs.
A light came on from the direction of the kitchen. A few seconds later, there was a tremendous, beastly howl.
Like how I imagined a demon might sound. Run, the voice urged. Get out of here.
I didn't question the wisdom of the advice, despite being barefoot and in my underwear.
As quickly and quietly as I could, I descended the stairs.
I cut my foot on the broken glass by the front door, but didn't let it slow me down. I opened the door and raced down the street.
A police car was turning the corner as I reached the intersection. I shouted and waved them down. There's someone in my house. They broke in.
Okay,
the officer driving said in a calm, authoritative voice.
Where do you live?
I pointed back up the street. 922, the Brown House.
His partner made a report on his radio.
The driver noticed the growing puddle of blood under the foot I had cut on the glass.
Are you all right?
I followed his gaze to my injury and lifted my foot. Blood was trickling out, but it wasn't too serious.
I think so.
Backup's on the way. I called for a bus, too, the other officer said.
Should we take a look?
He asked his partner. The first officer shined a flashlight in my face.
You say there's just one person?
I thought about the voice that had warned me of the intruder.
Yes, I replied, as far as I know.
All right, stay here. There's an ambulance on the way.
I nodded, then watched as the patrol car slowly crept up the street. Before they got there, an explosion ripped open the night. A bright flash was followed closely by a deafening boom that shook the air. My house and parts of the neighboring structures burst into flames. I sat down in the grass, thinking how just moments earlier I was asleep in my bed. If the intruder hadn't woken me up, it was the intruder, right? Not the voice I had imagined. And I hadn't fled. I would be inside right now. I would be dead. Had my long-lost Aunt Judith saved me? As if in answer to my question, I felt a sudden chill wash over me. I laid back and passed out. The drive to my uncle's cabin in Alaska took us along a barely navigable road, one that looked like it washed out frequently during spring thaws. The local sheriff handled it like it was nothing, while I dug my nails into the dashboard with every bump. The structure looked very sturdy, built from hewn logs with small windows and a metal door set in gaps in the timbers.
This is where he lived? I asked.
Yep, mostly kept to himself. Came into town once or twice a month,
the sheriff told me. Have you ever been inside?
Nope. Can't say I know anyone other than Steve that has been.
We stepped out of the Jeep and walked up to the front door. I pulled the key ring I had brought with me out of my backpack. It had been among the items that survived the fire. The police determined that the man who had broken into my house that night was my Uncle Steve. Dental records and the oval of turquoise that had decorated his bolo tie confirmed his identity.
The detectives speculated there was something in the house that he wanted, something of value that he didn't want to share with me. The explosion was blamed on a gas leak in the basement. Bad timing for Uncle Steve, and my good fortune that I had the good sense to flee when I heard him breaking in. I never told anyone about the voice, claiming to be my long-dead Aunt Judith. Now, 4 weeks later, I was at the cabin where Uncle Steve had spent most of his life. I put the key in the lock and turned it, then opened the door. The cabin was dark and musty. I stepped aside to let the sheriff in first. He had his own reasons for wanting to check out Steve's cabin, and never had the opportunity to do so while he was alive. The structure was a single room. In one corner was a tiny kitchen, in another was a bed. An old sofa and chair filled a third corner. In the fourth one, there was a cage. It was about 4 feet on each side. Manacles hung from loops welded in place. There was a soiled blanket on the floor, and what looked like a pet's dish. "He had a dog?" I asked.
"Not that I know of," the sheriff said. "Don't touch anything."
He walked over to the cage and looked it over. There was a large wooden chest not too far away. He slipped on a purple glove and lifted the lid. I could tell from the look on his face that his suspicions were confirmed. There had been a string of unsolved disappearances in the area, stretching back more than 40 years. The authorities had questioned Steve on several occasions, but never had enough evidence to search the cabin.
"Pardon me for saying this, but your uncle was about as evil a man as I have ever seen."
I crossed the small cabin to get a look at what was inside the chest. It was filled with broken skulls. Some of them still had bits of flesh and hair clinging to them. "He was a demon," I said absently. I slipped my backpack off my shoulder and opened it. Inside was the jar. Its spring clamp was tightly in place. An inky blackness filled it. Somehow, it had survived both the explosion and the fire. When it was safe for me to dig through the ashes after the fire department and police were done with their investigations, I found a portion of the kitchen cabinets that had survived somehow. And inside that cupboard was the jar. I lifted it up, feeling its weight.
"What's that?" the sheriff asked.
I wanted to tell him it was the demon who had possessed my uncle, after it had fled from his sister nearly 70 years ago, that somehow Judith had freed her brother of it and captured its evil essence in the same jar that had imprisoned her soul for decades. That would have explained everything and put the story to rest, if anyone actually believed it. "It's my uncle's ashes," I lied. "I was going to spread them out here, but maybe I'll just flush them down the nearest toilet."
"Seems about right," the sheriff agreed. "Sorry, I'm sure this isn't what you were hoping to find when you came up here."
I didn't know him very well at all. I didn't know what to expect.
"Well, let me get you back into town. I need to call the state police, probably the FBI, to sort this all out anyway."
"Thanks." We drove back to the small town where Uncle Steve did his shopping, where he, or rather the demon that lived inside him, stalked his victims. I never returned to my hometown. I took the insurance money from the fire and built a house in a neighboring state. In the basement, I constructed a concrete vault with a cast iron door. Inside that vault is a small cupboard. And sitting on a shelf in that cupboard is a jar. And in that jar is the soul of Uncle Steve.
The demon lives inside me now,
and we have so much work to do. Thank you for listening to The Jar in the Cupboard, written especially for the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs Fiction Podcast by Rich Hosek. Please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Rate us on Apple, Spotify, and Audible. and share these stories, as well as the unabridged audiobook versions of my novels, with anyone you know who enjoys audio fiction. Be sure to visit bedtimestories.studio, where you can sign up for our Insomniacs Snooze Letter to be notified of new episodes and exclusive offers, and get a free bookmark. You can visit richhosick.com to learn more about the host of Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs. Thanks again, and all the very best.